You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hi, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every week, Spycast brings you interesting conversations with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns about Spycast, or if you want to suggest someone who might be a good future guest, email us at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Also, if you like what you hear, and even if you don't, please take a minute to review us on iTunes or whatever platform you might be listening. We're always looking for ways to make Spycast better, and you can help. I'll tell you more about this new podcast later, but first, let's meet our guest. So we're joined today by Josh Campbell, who's a CNN law enforcement analyst, providing insight on crime, justice, and national security issues. Prior to joining CNN, he was a supervisory special agent with the FBI and served as special assistant to the FBI director. During his 12-year career, he conducted numerous high-profile terrorism and kidnapping investigations, served overseas in multiple diplomatic and operational assignments, and managed the Bureau's interagency communication response strategy following crisis and incidents. So welcome, Josh. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us here at Spycast.
Thanks, Vince. I'm a big fan, so thanks for having me.
We have a lot to talk about. Even when we started having a conversation about doing this podcast a little while ago, there's been 20 things since. And we would normally start chronologically and work our way to the present, but you just returned from Istanbul covering a murder investigation with international consequences. So for before we dig into your bio, before we kind of work our way up from the past, let's talk briefly about this case, because there's a lot going on here. There's a collision of intelligence professionals, diplomats, journalists, all coming together in a crazy story that continues to evolve every single day.
Absolutely.
So let me ask you about this, because this is something where these are two allies of the United States, the Saudis and the Turks. I mean, Turkey's a member of NATO, and Saudi is one of our top allies in the Middle East. How ugly is this with us being kind of pulled into the middle of it?
Yeah, so, I mean, you nailed it as far as how thorny the issue is when you have two allies of the United States. Obviously, you know, with Turkish authorities, we have, you know, strong intelligence sharing relationships with them. And then obviously with Saudi, you know, they're position as a regional ally obviously is very important on a number of fronts. And so when you have those two things colliding with an international murder investigation, it's made things, you know, very difficult, obviously, for the United States government. And it's been interesting to watch how the Trump administration has tried to kind of thread the needle and work their way through this issue. Obviously, the president has received a lot of criticism for accepting, essentially on face value, the initial Saudi claims about what happened. Problem, though, as I saw, and even being on the ground in Istanbul, is that the Saudi narrative has continued to shift. You know, first it started out that, okay, you know, we weren't involved, and then it was maybe this was a set of rogue actors, and then now the intelligence apparatus there is essentially bearing the brunt of the blame. And so you have kind of, you know, obviously the shifting narrative, which makes it difficult to believe. But also on the Turkish side, they're also, you know, not completely pure here, because we haven't seen a lot of the evidence that so far has been making its way in strategic leaks in Turkish newspapers. And I can tell you, you know, being there on the ground in Istanbul, there is a direct line from the intelligence apparatus to some of the very friendly state media sources. And, you know, they would kind of dole out nuggets of information. Take, for example, this audio recording, which, you know, none of us have heard. But, you know, there were slowly these strategic leaks about what it was that the Turkish authorities had. But we didn't really have the full picture. So, again, you have two sides that are obviously posturing for their own reasons. And that's all kind of come together with obviously the United States caught in the middle. And then you couple that with the fact this is a journalist, and so it's receiving international interest. It's really made for a very thorny issue. And again, you know, we're going now on a month since the killing, and we really don't have a lot of answers.
Well, it seems like the Turks are trying to have their cake and eat it too. They're trying to get information out that makes them look good without completely burning sources and methods. I mean, there's a lot of speculation about how they have a recording inside the Saudi embassy in Istanbul, and the surveillance photos and footage that have been released and trickled out are giving away some sources and methods, but it seems like they're trying to hold back so that they don't give the whole show away.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And, you know, in talking with some of the intelligence sources on the ground there, that seemed to be a part of a strategy that, you know, I was talking with one person who said, look, you know, we're not releasing this right now because we really don't have to. I mean, if you think about it from a strategic standpoint, I mean, they're basically now putting the Saudis back on their heels. You know, but for the allegations that this consulate was wired up, that they had bugged this building, the Saudi narrative may have held. They may have been able to kind of get away with this body double, you know, that we were reporting at CNN that, you know, left out the back door. And, you know, but for this audio, they might have been able to say, look, he left. We don't know what happened to him. But I think when the Turkish authorities came out and started kind of with those strategic leaks saying, no, we bugged this facility. We have audio. That then, you know, obviously made things very uncomfortable for Saudi authorities. And again, in talking with, you know, intelligence sources there on the ground, they mentioned that, look, you know, we don't have to really lay this out right now. It's doing what we want right now. And then one other thing that's interesting, Vince, that they mentioned is that, at least from a strategic standpoint from the Turkish government, they said, you know, our goal isn't to topple the Saudi government. I mean, if we released audio that was damning in nature and showed, you know, a brutal murder, or at least, you know, indications of a brutal murder, then they were afraid that might actually cause these consequences maybe beyond what they were actually intending. They said, look, we're not trying to topple the Saudi government. We're simply trying to find those who are responsible and hold them accountable. And if that goes up to the crown prince, well, so be it. But again, we're still very much in this diplomatic tit for tat. And, you know, recently, CIA Director Haspel went over. You know, it's been reported that she actually had heard some of this audio. So, again, it'll be interesting to see what the U.S. government does as far as coming out and now confirming, you know, what intelligence they have, or if they just leave it to, you know, continue to be a more of a regional issue. But again, it's not going away. And this is one of those issues that, you know, obviously the White House is very adept at changing the narrative on any given day, you know, as far as the news cycle goes. But I'm confident that this is an issue that's going to continue to come back, because it's simply there's so much brutality there when you think about a journalist working for an American outlet that then went overseas and was killed. You know, we have to have answers to what happened there.
Well, it's not just a journalist. He was a green card holding resident alien. He was somebody who was legally, you know, a permanent resident of the United States. I mean, while it's not full-fledged citizenship, it's somebody that we're supposed to protect a little bit.
Well, and that was the issue, right? So you know, we'd received reporting that he had applied for an LPR, for a green card. There were questions as far as whether he actually got one, whether he actually was a permanent resident. But, you know, setting that aside, as you mentioned, I mean, this is someone living in the United States. And again, the question comes down to, is there, at least in the mind of the White House, an interest on behalf of the United States in finding out what happened? Now, there's long been this question of, as far as, you know, should the president get the FBI involved? And he actually said at one point, well, we have investigators over there. That is not consistent with what we have been, determining from folks that we've been talking to as far as a level of involvement by the FBI. But again, if he was really interested in getting to the bottom of what happened, he could easily direct the FBI to, ask questions. Obviously, they would require permission before they conducted any investigative activity on the ground in either Istanbul or Riyadh. But again, just I think even signaling that he's interested, that he wants American investigators to really dig into this, I think would say a lot as far as how important the United States government sees this. And I think the fact that we haven't seen that actually speaks volumes.
You'd mentioned that the intelligence services and the Saudis are taking the brunt of the blame for this. And in many cases, people are arguing they've been scapegoated because the Saudi government, it's pretty aristocratic. It's pretty authoritarian. It's not like it's a representative democracy. That there's very little that happens inside the kingdom that doesn't come from the top. So is this the perception of most people within not only the U.S. government, but also the Turks, that it's very not believable to think that this was some kind of rogue operation by the Saudi intelligence service?
So people in and outside of government that I've been speaking with and doing reporting on this story seem to come to the same conclusion. That is something with such international ramifications as, you know, this is someone who's a very public figure. This isn't just, you know, some unknown entity who then disappeared. This is someone who was very well known and obviously, you know, was working with the Washington Post. And so there's that Washington angle. And again, someone who people knew about. So the idea that, you know, say they were actually intending to render him back to Saudi Arabia, which is one of the narratives. Again, the idea that that would happen absent some type of knowledge from the highest levels of Saudi government is just simply not believable. And then you take that with, okay, if the goal was actually to execute him, to kill him, which again, the narrative is shifting, but that's some of the latest reporting we've seen. And Turkish prosecutors have indicated that, at least according to their investigation, they indicated this was premeditated murder. So again, if that were the intended goal, that would also have to go up to the highest levels of the Saudi government. So it's simply not believable to think that there weren't high-level officials who were, if not giving the green light, then at least were aware of what was going on. But again, it's, you know, it's the classic intelligence operations. When things go south, you start pointing fingers, and you know, folks in the intelligence community know that oftentimes they're going to catch a lot of the blowback. Again, just so many questions because it is so opaque as far as the operations within the Saudi kingdom. We don't know if this was an intelligence operation, you know, trying to do something that they thought the government might like, or if it was something that was directed on high. But again, it's so difficult to grasp and believe that something with such international ramifications wouldn't have been signed off at high levels.
Even after 9/11, where the vast majority of the hijackers were Saudi, there's been a bit of a truce between the Saudi royal family and journalists around the world. There hasn't been a lot of deep digging, at least among mainstream journalists, of the money and corruption inside Saudi Arabia. It seems like killing a journalist, or however you want to qualify him. I know some people have been like, he was a contributor to the Post, but people in journalism are treating him as a journalist. Seems pretty stupid for the Saudis, because the best way to get back at them from a journalistic perspective is to just dig deep.
That's right. No, it's right. And I mean, the whole operation seems so ham-handed as far as the target, the operation, the planning, and then what do you do if it goes south? Again, it's, you know, I know the Saudi intelligence services to be, you know, very good at what they do. So the fact that this thing was just, you know, so ridiculously planned and executed, so to speak. I mean, it's, again, it just kind of smacks of just, you know, something that we're not used to coming from that government. Obviously, there are the human rights issues. We know that they're there. And you're right that, you know, it seems, at least in the last few years, that those types of, you know, human rights violations have made their way off the front pages, because folks in the United States government continue to look at, okay, how strong the Saudis are as a strategic ally. And I think they often turn a blind eye to a lot of things. But this has kind of brought that back into the mix and brought back, you know, obviously, to the front of mind for a lot of people in this business, that look, this is a regime that does engage in brutality, and the fact that they would either render or, you know, set out to kill a contributor, a journalist, whatever you want to call them, again, shows that level of brutality is still there. The question is now, you know, what does the U.S. government do about it? Is this something that they're just going to look at and say, well, the strategic alliance is too important? It's not worth risking everything that we're benefiting regionally from the Saudis to actually hold them accountable. I think that's the way it's headed, because we saw the president actually come out immediately and essentially take these arms sales off the table and say, no, we're not going to lose billions of dollars over this journalist, which again is such a craven thing to think about. But that shows the mindset of how a lot of folks, you know, deal with. And we know, I mean, folks, you and I and other folks in the business know that, you know, diplomacy and international relations, and especially intelligence, is not a black and white business. There are so many shades of gray, and it's very much zero sum, in that, you know, you're dealing with one regime may impact you're dealing with another regime. And so you have to make a cost benefit analysis and obviously calculated action. But again, the question comes down to a lot of people when you look at the brutality of what happened do our values matter more to us than a strategic alliance or the bottom line when it comes to weapon sales? Sadly, it looks as though those issues are at least being held, at least weighted higher than, than our own values.
So let's take a walk back and now work our way up chronologically. And let's talk about you and your decision to join the FBI. Is this something you worked towards specifically in college, or was it something that once you had graduated from school, you thought, oh, the FBI might be a good idea?
Yeah, so I'd always had an interest, even in high school in international relations and, things going on outside the U.S. border. And so I knew that I suspected that my career track would be in foreign policy or some type of related field. I was a freshman at the University of Texas at Austin 1 week in, and 9/11 happens, and for me that really sealed the deal. Where at that point my trajectory was more looking more to go the diplomacy route, but for me that really sealed the deal as far as okay, no, this is something that I want to do as far as help investigate and not only work with foreign nations but also really dig into the investigative side to use my skills. Those skill sets to actually benefit the U.S. government and protect the American people. And so after 9/11, I mean, again, 1 week into my college career, there was no question that was the direction that I wanted to head. And so everything past that was oriented towards joining the Bureau. And I had, obviously, taken a course load and studied foreign language. And, I actually interned for the Bureau my junior year. And then upon graduation was fortunate enough to join full time.
Well, a lot of what you describe sounds like it would be also relevant to other agencies. Talk about foreign policy, and you talked about things about wanting to do things overseas. That would certainly lend itself to potentially another three-letter agency that we know and love. What drove you to the FBI in particular?
Yeah, so the FBI. I'd done research and had learned as much as I could about the organization. And up at that point, I thought of the FBI as a purely domestic force. The FBI agents on the street that you think about that are working bank robberies and crime and obviously threats here at home. But in doing the research, I learned that there's actually this other side of the FBI, which to be sure is a lot smaller than the rest of the operation, but it's the side that deals with foreign governments, the international operations side, the extraterritorial investigative side, where they actually will deploy agents overseas to work with foreign governments, and they have agents that are assigned in embassies. And so as I learned more about that, that was kind of the melding of two interests. So you had the law enforcement investigative side, but also the foreign policy side. So that was of interest. And I'll say, I wasn't, again, it would be ego on my part to think, okay, I'm only going to apply to one organization and I know I'm going to get in. That wasn't the case. So I applied to CIA as well and went through that process because, again, it's, obviously an organization with a tremendous mission. And we can talk about some of my work with them embedded overseas, but just great, great people, true patriots. And at the end of the day, it just actually ended up the FBI was a lot faster than CIA. When it came to the application process. So again, I knew and thought that, okay, the Bureau is where I'm headed. But again, I didn't totally discount, the agency. That was obviously another organization that would allow one to fulfill those same goals, patriotism and service, in the national security space.
So we have a lot of listeners who are undergrads, grad students, early career professionals that still haven't figured out what they want to be when they grow up. Can you provide any advice for those who want this kind of a career, focus on foreign policy, but also, serving the nation, and how to get into the FBI? Because it's become not a lot harder. It was hard when you got in, certainly, but it's become very difficult to get into some of these high-profile agencies.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I like to do, and I still do, even my post-FBI career, is to talk to young people that are interested in either career in law enforcement or intelligence and, field questions and serve as that sounding board. Obviously, there are things that I wish I knew when I was applying and joining. And one of the things that I often tell people, and I'll speak specifically about the FBI, is that there's this this idea that in order to join, become a federal agent, to join federal law enforcement, you need to study criminology or, some type of behavioral science or criminal justice. All those things are great, obviously, that, police departments around the country are filled with people with that expertise, but the FBI, it's actually there's a different there's a different strategy one can employ to make themselves more competitive. And it's not to look at the criminal justice side, but it's to look at, okay, what are the critical issues that the FBI is looking for right now? And these things kind of shift, they kind of change. But one of them that's always there, at least as of late since 9/11, is a foreign language. And I'll tell you, you know, when you have people that are on paper, you know, equally qualified, you've done the interview, they look like solid people, but one of them speaks a foreign language, and especially a hard foreign language, in the FBI, it's a no-brainer. Okay, that person is now ahead of the pack. And especially on kind of opening the aperture a little bit, so talking about the intelligence community in general, and I'd throw in state and, you know, the diplomatic side, there are a lot of smart people in the United States government that are good at formulating ideas that are, you know, that can orbit tough issues and formulate strategies and, you know, obviously do the meat of the work that involved in diplomacy and law enforcement, national security. But if you can't communicate that to a foreign government, or you don't bring that added benefit to the table where, you know the hard languages, you can, you know, bring something to the table that other people don't have, then you're just, you know, one of many. And so that's a long-winded way of saying that, you know, the language abilities are so key and so critical, and they're never going away. So if you're a college freshman right now, I mean, if you're a high school sophomore right now that's listening to this podcast, start studying those hard languages, because that's going to move you to the head of the pack. And again, you want to study a language that is obviously of interest to you. And, you know, with the language training comes cultural training. So, you know, find out what your interest, what your area of the world, you know, that interests you is, and then pursue that. But the sooner you start, the more competitive you're going to be.
Yeah, and avoid Sanskrit and Latin.
That's right.
Russian, Chinese, Arabic, Farsi, Spanish. Yeah, those are the ones.
You got it, exactly.
So you joined the FBI in 2005, which was just after the formal creation of the capital I, capital C intelligence community, the passage of IRTPA, the Intelligence Reform and Terrorism Prevention Act of 2004. So you kind of got in not knowing things any differently than what had been created with the reorganization of the intelligence community after 9/11. But were there difficulties adjusting among those who had been around? You know, joined this unit in LA, you talked already about the extraterritorial squad. Were there olders at FBI who were kind of trying to figure out the new way things were going, or was it pretty smooth sailing?
No, it wasn't smooth sailing. And, you know, within the FBI, and you have to think about that space and time. So, you know, obviously on the heels of 2004, you have the 9/11 Commission report. And, you know, one of the topics of intense conversation from that period, which I think a lot of folks have forgotten about with the distance of time, but a lot of people inside the FBI know it very well. And, you know, I'll bring up a familiar name who's now, you know, made his way back into the headlines. But Bob Mueller, when he was the director of the FBI and going through this period, I don't think folks really appreciate how close the FBI came to being split into two organizations. So there was this debate as far as whether the MI5 model in the UK is the model that the U.S. government should adopt, where you have, you know, you leave the law enforcement to the cops. We'll carve that side of the FBI off. They can continue to do the bank robberies and everything they've done. But then we bring this new intelligence component that won't have arrest powers, but, you know, they'll be able to dig into a lot of these threats. Again, the goal was stopping something like 9/11 and finding all the different failures that were there and trying to work backwards to figure out if there was another agency, if there were people with different authorities, what would they be able to do? And I have to tell you, you know, inside the organization, it came so close to being, you know, seriously considered in Congress that, okay, this is legislation we're going to enact, or at least, you know, put forward. But it was really Bob Mueller who was leading that charge, saying, no, the FBI can handle this. We've handled intelligence since our founding, 100 years ago, you know, at that point. And so this is something that we can do. And so to answer your question, at that point, you know, once you have these new laws and new authorities coming in, people were still a little skittish, thinking, okay, any time if we screw this up, then we're going to go back to that debate whether the FBI is really up to the task. And obviously the Bureau has shown, I mean, I'm biased, but the Bureau has shown they are up to the task. You look at the number of threats that have been mitigated since that period of time up to now. I mean, it's really incredible when you think about some of these operations, most known, some not known. A lot of work with international partners that's not known, as far as, you know, really leveraging relationships and doing the work the FBI and the CIA, for that matter, are you know, they're tasked to do. And then one other interesting part, as far as a cultural shift, you know, we always talk, and it's kind of now cliche post 9/11 about this, you know, before it was you had to have a need to know, and then afterwards you have it's a need to share, kind of a reorienting of a mindset of how you actually share information with different agencies. But and I remember very vividly talking with a very senior FBI person at the time right when I first came in, asking this very same question, like, how hard has this been to really move to this shift in the intelligence community where now you're being a little more forthcoming? And he said it's going very well, but not motivated by the reason you think. I mean, the CIA, FBI are obviously lashed up sharing information, not because they think, okay, this is a great thing to do, but it's actually a little more sinister than that. They're saying no one wants to be holding on to a piece of intelligence that wasn't shared when something goes boom. And again, whatever the motivation is, that's the right way to move forward as far as, you know, getting information and sharing it. And so this was all taking place in that period of time that you're talking about. So you have this culture. And even in the FBI today, I'll tell you just you know, very briefly on this topic, you still have remnants of that mindset where there are people that looked at what Bob Mueller did in the wake of 9/11 and said, no, you know, the FBI, the bread and butter are the arrests, the criminal work, the drugs, the bank robberies, and then this entire new you know, mindset that was, you know, not only forced on us, but people coming in like me who came in, you know, after 9/11, who wanted to work the national security side. So it wasn't punitive whenever you came in and you were assigned to a terrorism squad. That was something that you actually wanted to do. So with time, it's just become accepted that that's the way the organization is. I mean, you can do both. We have a national security mission and a criminal mission. And again, you know, things take time, right? You always talk about, you know, moving the changing direction of the aircraft carrier. You know, doesn't happen immediately. And so it's taken time, but I've seen this cultural shift where it's just now accepted that, okay, this is what we're going to do. We're going to incorporate intelligence. We're going to, you know, really focus on the national security space while we do these other things.
When I was looking at your bio and I saw that you were in the extraterritorial squad starting in 2005 and you were there for several years, what jumped out at me immediately was arguably one of the most infamous terrorist attacks in world history, and at least because of the kind of media coverage it got and because of the impact that it has, and that was Mumbai in 2008. How involved, I know the FBI was brought in, how involved were you in the investigation after that attack?
Yeah, so that was one of the pivotal cases of my career, and that was actually worked out of the Los Angeles field office where I was assigned. So the FBI divides the globe into four different regions as far as its extraterritorial responsibility, and Los Angeles essentially covers South Asia and Southeast Asia. And so I was on the team that worked that investigation. And my role, again, this was, you know, no one does anything alone in the FBI, and in this type of investigation where, you know, you have so many that are killed, so many that are injured, so many different there's so much U.S. interest as far as American connection points and communication mediums and a lot of ways for America to assist with this investigation. It was very much an all hands on deck in the Los Angeles field office. You know, we had a ton of people working on this. We deployed a team forward. These were a lot of the experienced agents who had worked bombings and, you know, evidence collection and the like. And so they were working forward. I started out initially really trying to dig into the communication mediums that were used by the attackers. And so that was kind of my expertise in the communication side and the cyber side. And if you remember at the time, I mean, we take it for granted now, but the Mumbai attack was so sophisticated in that you had controllers that were in Pakistan in a control room watching, you know, banks of live television directly communicating with the attackers, telling them where to go, what to do, the posture of law enforcement, you know, where to fire, I mean, down to a lot of those details. And so what we were trying to figure out, because at this point we assumed that it was being directed at Pakistan, we really couldn't prove it. And so we really had to dig into that communication side. And I can tell you a lot of stuff I still can't tell you, but we created a lot of we made a lot of headway in the digital space as far as electronic surveillance capabilities based on that case that ended up taking a lot of people off the battlefield, because a lot of these, you know, mediums that they were using were mediums that other terrorist groups were using. And being able to dig into the TTPs, you know, the tactics that these attackers were using really opened up a window into what other groups were doing. And so it was just a really fascinating case all around as far as the ramification. This was another instance, actually, you know, tying it back to Khashoggi, where you had two major countries that were at odds with each other over, a brutal act. And so there were similarities there as well that, you know, we were working with state and obviously the diplomatic side and National Security Council. I mean, just it was so multifaceted. That's one of the investigations that really had an impact on me. And then just the FBI moving forward, because even domestically, when law enforcement agencies within the United States, you know, we're always planning based on the last attack, and that really became the focus to stop a Mumbai-style attack from happening here in the United States.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, you're not just the only person. The FBI is their team holistically. That's also the case in between agencies, where a lot of times you're working overseas the FBI, but you're also working alongside the broader diplomatic mission, which means working with State Department people, the broader national security mission, which means working alongside CIA and DOD personnel. How easy was that interagency cooperation during some of these, both like something like Mumbai, a major attack, but also kind of a day-to-day perspective?
So after, and I mean, this is an unfortunate reality, but after a successful attack or a successful incident, the government, the U.S. government fuses together very well. And I've, you know, worked a number of these incidents from South and Southeast Asia where you'd have a bombing or you'd have a killing. And you know, again, the agencies that the whatever turf issues that were in place before quickly go away. And so you have diplomats, you have FBI agents, you have CIA officers and analysts that are really coming together to figure out, okay, what happened here? And again, the goal is to find the people that are responsible. Where it gets a little grayer is when you don't actually have an incident, but you might have a threat. And so, I talked earlier about how we share information. The one area that, you know, obviously agencies try to keep their cards close to the vest comes to sources. There were a number of instances where whether it was FBI or CIA or even state through their liaison, they would get tips and information that would and I include DOD into that, by the way. I don't want to forget them, that they would get information that would be of interest to the others. And we would really want to drill down on, OK, where did this come from? Not because we just wanted to know who their source was, but because we wanted to figure out, OK, is this a larger threat that we're just not really seeing? And so I saw some issues there, interagency and the FBI. We weren't pure as well. I mean, we didn't want to give up everything when it came to sources. But again, there was a kind of that constant reminder that, you know, if we don't share as much as we can, then, you know, if something happens, will this have been the piece of information that may have helped someone else connect a dot that maybe we didn't see? And so, again, that's something that continues through time as far as operations. Every time you recruit a source, you try to figure out, okay, what interest is this person to other agencies? But again, you don't want to give up too much for fear of burning that person. So it's an ongoing struggle.
Later on, you served as the national spokesman for the FBI Counterterrorism, Cyber, and International Operations Division. I think that I wonder how maybe this was more difficult than a lot of other things that you did, just the idea of dissemination of information to the public. How hard was it to figure out what you can and can't say? I mean, you've already kind of talked about it a little bit here, like there's things I can't say, but you want, as a policy, I understand you weren't making the policy, you were enacting it, but as a policy, the FBI has to make tough calls, just the same way you're talking about the Turkish government, right? Make tough calls in how much to tell the public. You want them to be informed in a democracy, but at the same time, you have to protect sources and methods.
Right. I think there's always a balance there. And I remember debating this with colleagues, you know, from the squad bay in Los Angeles to, some jungle overseas where we're working on an operation. And that is, you know, how much of what we're doing does the public need to know? And it's a constant debate. And there's one camp, you know, inside the FBI, and I would say, you know, writ large inside the intelligence community, who says, you know, we do the job. The people should just trust that you know, we're doing what we need to do. They don't need to know the specifics. And it's not so much that they just don't want to share information. It's they really look at that through the lens of, okay, what we're doing is so sensitive that we can't be talking about this, to the public and to the American people. Whereas I tend to tack the other direction, and that is, okay, you can always say something, right, about what you're doing. Yeah, you're not going to give up important sources and methods. You're not going to give up intelligence. But my viewpoint is that the public has to have a certain amount of confidence in their intelligence community. Because if you look, I mean, just go back from, you know, the church committees where there were all these things that came to light that the public really didn't know about specifically. And it took a lot of time to build that public confidence back up. Whereas if you thought about, okay, what if we take a different approach and, you know, try to assure the American people to the extent that we can without giving up sensitive sources that, you know, we're on the job, we're on the case, we're doing exactly what they expect, and, you know, we're doing it lawfully. We're not just, you know, running rogue here. And then another issue is, and this is something that is more philosophical, but it's something that I really believe in, and I would tell, once I, you know, started working my way up in leadership, I would tell my teams that, look, you know, we are benefiting right now from the FBI brand. So when an FBI agent goes and knocks on someone's door and shows that badge, shows the credentials, there is an immediate sense of trust that one garners from the other party. When an FBI agent rises in the courtroom and testifies, there's a certain reputation that comes with that person saying, I'm with the FBI. And what I would tell them is, look, that wasn't you. You didn't create that. You know, you're benefiting from that, from the work that other people did, you know, before you. And a large portion of that is the public affairs, public relations side, and ensuring the public is aware, at least to some extent, of what you're doing. So if you are not helping contribute to the strength of that brand, to, you know, helping the public understand that it's still the bureau that you remember, that the reputation is still strong, then you're basically just a freeloader because you're benefiting now from everything people did before you, but you're not actually contributing to that. So that really drove my interest in the public affairs space, is really trying to help tell the FBI story to the public about what it is that we're doing, at least to the extent we can. And then the last part, which is, you know, fascinating, is that there, especially with law enforcement, not so much on the intelligence side, but with law enforcement, the public is a huge force multiplier when it comes to solving crime. And so if you're not out there talking about the FBI's top 10 most wanted list and, you know, talking about fugitives and talking about tips and things that you need from the public, then you're basically, you know, you're handcuffed, because here are all these potential sources of information out there who may assist your case. And that requires you actually telling them a little bit about what you're doing.
Well, you just made my segue pretty easy, because I was going to reference the letter or the op-ed that you wrote in the Washington Post, where you talk a lot about this, where you lay out these exact issues you've been talking about. And so I do want to shift over to your decision to leave the FBI, because it certainly sounds like you enjoyed what you were doing. At the end of your time there, you were the special assistant to Director Jim Comey during the 2016 election season. And you were there on the day he was fired and then shifted over to serve on Andrew McCabe's office. And actually, incidentally, you also, when you became an FBI agent, you were given your badge and credentials by Bob Mueller. So let me ask you about leaving the FBI, and I'm not going to get political. You can do whatever you want. But I do want to ask you about the decision that you made to leave a bureau that you seem to really enjoy working for.
Yeah, so I mean, you nailed it. I mean, the FBI is an organization like any other institution on the planet. Obviously, I'm biased. You know, I spent a lot of time in there. But the work, the people, I mean, it's incredible. But if you think about what was going on at the end of 2016 and early 20 and throughout 2017, essentially, you know, you mentioned politics. I don't like talking about politics either, but it's hard to talk about that period of time without talking about politics. And what I'm about to describe, I don't want people to think what I'm saying is partisan, because it's not. I don't care what party you are, but it is political, because the FBI faced a tidal wave of attempted political interference and, you know, just all out nonsense on a daily basis in a way that they'd never faced before. We've had presidents that have been under FBI investigation. You know, if you think about Watergate or Iran-Contra or, you know, Whitewater, Lewinsky, all of that. I mean, you've had, you know, incidents and periods of time where the FBI and the White House were at odds, and it was uncomfortable for the White House. But we've never seen what we're seeing now, and that is an overt campaign to undermine federal law enforcement, to discredit the FBI, to discredit the Justice Department, and to discredit Bob Mueller for the sole purpose of undermining whatever results they actually come up with. And, you know, again, that's how people look at things through political lenses. They think, okay, who is my enemy? What is a potential liability? And how do I undermine them? And that's fair game of politics, right? If campaigns want to go back and forth with each other and say, I'm better than this person's terrible. But when you start using those same tactics against law enforcement, against the FBI, there are unintended long-term consequences that folks like President Trump and his allies, folks like Devin Nunes, either they don't appreciate or they just don't care about, because the slow chipping, you know, constant chipping away at the FBI's reputation is going to cause long-term consequences for public safety. And what I mean by that, if you go back to what we were just talking about, when an FBI agent stands in front of someone and is asking for assistance, their willingness to help the FBI is directly correlated with their view of the agency. When an FBI agent is trying to recruit a source to provide critical national security information, the willingness of that person to help and to possibly sacrifice in order to help the United States government is directly correlated with their view of the FBI as a trustworthy, honest force. And that is what's being, you know, essentially put at risk here, where you have a president who's saying, no, these people are corrupt. They're out to get me. This is a rigged system. This is a witch hunt. And what's interesting is that this isn't just, you know, it's not just us talking theory. I mean, there's polling that suggests that some of this is actually taking root. Just earlier this year, it was Gallup that came up with they came up with a poll talking about confidence in the FBI. And I don't care so much about the Democratic side, but what's interesting to me is the Republican side, because, you know, if you think about the quote unquote party of law enforcement, you know, people who are predisposed to support, not that Democrats don't, but when you think about law enforcement, you think people that are right of center. I know in the FBI, it's an organization that hews conservative. But of Republicans that were surveyed, less than half had confidence in the FBI, and that was down some 25 points over a couple years. So that tells me that the narrative is taking hold, at least among that set, you know, possibly the president's base, that they're starting to believe this nonsense, that the FBI is corrupt or, you know, they're out of control. Now, did the FBI make questionable decisions? Absolutely. You know, in 2016, were there some bad actors up there? Yeah, absolutely. I think the inspector general, you know, took that issue head on. But that doesn't speak for the entire organization, where if you look at the flip side of what, you know, the Trump administration has been doing as far as just constantly going after Mueller, constantly going after the FBI, they're working to undermine the credibility, again, without even appreciating or maybe even caring about what those long-term consequences are. So I say all that to say, you know, seeing this and feeling this inside the Bureau, people were just so frustrated and so furious about what the president was doing. You know, people were asking, well, who's going to speak up for us? Who's going to step up and say, no, this is the FBI I know. This is the organization I know. And I looked, you know, we can only speak for ourselves, but I surveyed the field, and the bench wasn't that deep as far as people actually stepping up to say, this needs to stop. Here are the reasons why. And so I came to the realization, and this wasn't a flip decision. I didn't make the decision when Comey got fired. I mean, I continued on. I was a career agent. But it was really down, you know, in late 2017 when the attacks just continued, and he actually had the president standing ready to board Marine One, saying, you know, telling the cameras and an international audience that it's a shame what's happened to the FBI. It's, you know, that was too much to take. And so what I decided, okay, I can only speak for myself. I don't want to just stay in the organization, keep my head down, and watch it continue to just take, you know, so many slings and arrows, and then look back 15 years from now in retirement and say, well, you know, I kept my head down, all as well. So I made that painful realization that the best way for me to really explain the FBI to the American people is on the outside and not on the inside. And I think that's the only right way to do it. You wouldn't want FBI agents on the inside anonymously going to reporters and, you know, talking about the administration and the White House. I mean, that's a slippery slope. That down that road is danger for the organization. And so I just realized, I came to that realization that I can do more good on the outside explaining the organization right now and not defending it, because, you know, the Bureau can defend itself. But whenever it comes under attack, to explain the difference between a righteous criticism and pure politics.
Hey everybody, today I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. And now a word from our sponsor, Sixth Sense. Sixth Sense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With SixthSense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. Visit SixthSense.com to learn why enterprises choose them.
About those that are critical of people like yourself, people like John Brennan, people like Jim Comey, who have become, or at least in their argument, overtly political as a way, as an argument that you guys are reinforcing the narrative that there was this cabal that was against Donald Trump, the kind of the deep state argument. Because I don't necessarily agree with it, but I can understand why people see people like Clapper and Brennan and you and Ned Price and Jim Comey, who are so vehemently against the administration, reinforcing and kind of building into that narrative something that people can point to. I mean, you mentioned that you needed a way to get out. You're certainly not Peter Strzok or Lisa Page, you know, being when you're still in the FBI. But there seems to be this is almost like just handing over an easy argument to be made for people that may not have an argument otherwise.
Yeah, I see that. And let me just take issue, if I can, with one thing you said there as far as people like me being totally against this administration. I am not. I'm not against the administration. I'm not even against Donald Trump writ large. I mean, there's some policies that I actually agree with. I'm independent-minded enough that, you know, I could look at issues. I can look at people. I've supported Republicans. I've supported Democrats. I used to work for the Republican Party, you know, back in the day before I joined the FBI, you know, in college. And so I'm not predisposed to ridicule what's going on through a partisan lens. And so I think it's important for people to understand that. What I'm doing is looking and saying the actions of people who happen to be Republicans that are in power. And that's President Trump. That's Devin Nunes. Again, I don't care what party they are. They all happen to be Republicans. But they control the levers of power. And with that power comes great responsibility. And that is also, you know, that also includes criticism whenever they misstep. And so what I've been trying to do, because, you know, we all have our areas of expertise and our areas of interest. And what I've been trying to do is when I see these political attacks against the intelligence community, when I see these political attacks against the FBI, is to stand up and say, look, this is nonsense, and to explain why. And so I don't just criticize just, you know, for criticism's sake. I don't say people are, you know, people in power are bad people. I say the decisions that they make are causing corrosive long-term consequences for public safety in the United States. And if people see that as criticism of the entire administration, then I think maybe they're looking at it through too much of a partisan lens. So that's what I want to say first. Secondly, to the point about people speaking out, and I don't necessarily put myself in the category of, you know, Brennan and Clapper and Comey, not only because I was nowhere near as senior as them, but also, you know, my role now at CNN isn't, I mean, there's an analysis role and then a reporting role. And so what I'll do is look at issues and say, okay, this, you know, let me tell you what I think about this, and then, you know, gather information that might be in the public interest. So my entire orientation in life is not about criticizing Donald Trump. It's just whenever he's talking about issues that I know what he's saying to be factually inaccurate, and I know what he's saying will cause long-term damage, I'm going to speak out about it. And that's what I'm doing. And then the last thing I'll say on that is that when I look at people like Clapper, Comey, when I look at people like Brennan, and people, and I understand the point that you're making here, that, you know, you raise about, well, could people see this as maybe proving the point of their detractors? But what I would ask you is, what is the alternative? For these people who have spent their lives dedicated to public service, who these people have spent their lives in intelligence, and these aren't partisans. These are people, again, who have dedicated their careers to the national security space, to working on tough issues, to protecting the American people. You know, what is the alternative for them when they see what's going on now? If they stay quiet, then the narrative continues to take hold, and people don't have a counter view about what the president's saying. But if they do speak out, then it allows them to at least speak from, you know, a position based on experience because they've been in the space, but also, again, these are people who love the organizations that they're speaking on behalf of. And so, again, I just don't know what the alternative is for someone who's spent a career in government to look at someone coming in and trying to destroy these institutions and norms and not speaking out. I don't understand how people can sleep at night, if you didn't speak up.
You've talked about words making a difference in the way people perceive the FBI. We've seen now recently where words have been accused of making a difference when it comes to inciting violence. And in this case, I'm now talking about the mail bombings of now a week ago or a little over a week ago. Are we not paying enough attention as a society to internal terrorism threats? I mean, we seem to be having this conversation again and again. I mean, I'm going to age you. You're too young to remember the conversation after Oklahoma City, but the conversations we've had every time since there's been a major domestic terrorism incident seems to be, why aren't we paying more attention to this? Are we at a point now where maybe we can shift that focus?
So it's always difficult to talk about in the wake of a deadly incident to, or and even potential deadly incidents, to talk about, okay, well, this is limited in scope. This isn't really a widespread, problem, because again, it's the response is so visceral. We're still grieving for what happened at the synagogue in Pittsburgh. I'm still thinking about my colleagues at CNN who were evacuating the New York City office because there was a pipe bomb in their building, right? And so, fortunately, these things haven't happened a lot. We don't see that. But I think that, looking kind of to the point as far as, how widespread an issue it is, and then even taking a step further about what to do about it, I don't think that we should ignore the impact that words have on segments of the population. And again, this goes back to people in power. The President of the United States, Donald Trump, is the most powerful person in the world. His words matter. When he's whipping people up and, he's calling the press the enemy of the people and, inciting his people into whipping them up into this rage, then obviously he bears some responsibility for the narrative and tone. Now, there's been this debate where obviously the White House came out right after the attack saying, how dare you say that we're responsible for any of this? And I think that they're whistling past the graveyard here and not really appreciating the power of the presidency and the impact that his words have on people that are predisposed to act on violence. He's not liable for this person in Pittsburgh who went and shot up a synagogue. He's not 100% liable for a person who was sending package bombs who just happened to have pictures of Donald Trump all over his van. But he does bear some responsibility for the tone that he sets in America. And I don't think we can lose sight of the fact that, again, if you're an elected leader, if you're a person in power, you are treated differently. Your words matter. And you have to appreciate that with leadership comes a certain following, and if a certain number of those followers are predisposed to act with violence based on, the tone that you're setting, then you have to assume that responsibility. And the reason why we assume this responsibility is not just so we could say, okay, we figured out who's liable. It's so we can nip these things in the bud. Like, if you look at the public safety issue that we have in the country right now when it comes to some of the language, some of the tone. I don't look at it through a political lens. I look at it through a public safety lens. And, if leaders don't check themselves and don't bring down the temperature, then, again, they have a role to play in the public safety conversation. I just think it's a missed opportunity by the White House. I think they could have come out and said, look, we understand that there's this population out there. We understand that, tensions are running high. Things are very toxic. Here's what we're going to do to help alleviate that. That's leadership. We haven't seen that.
I think something missing from some of the conversation about these mail bombings is the fact that I would argue if it wasn't for the first several bombs being sent to insanely well-guarded people, meaning the Obamas, the Clintons, then the alert wouldn't have been out for places like CNN, for individuals that don't necessarily have Secret Service protection. And obviously, people were on high alert after there were bombs sent to the Clintons and to Obamas. I'm wondering, and kind of frighteningly wondering, if the first bomb had been sent to Robert De Niro or to CNN in Atlanta, and maybe it would have gotten through if it wasn't for the fact that everyone was on high alert. And so I think the people that are kind of saying, oh, none of these went off, none of these were a big deal, are missing the bigger point.
Right. I mean, if you think about, you mentioned the package that went to De Niro. So the reason that that was intercepted was, as you mentioned, because people already knew about the others. And there was actually a retired police officer who was working security at that facility who saw the media reporting, saw the pictures on TV, and then remembered seeing this package and then put two and two together. So you're right. If that would happen in a reverse order, it may have been a lot different. I think that, you know, one argument that I've seen that, again, I understand that people posture, especially in the political realm, they try to distance themselves from, you know, from any responsibility when these kind of things happen. But I don't think the conversation about the efficacy of the device is as important as the conversation about what this person intended to do. So none of them went off, right? 100% failure rate if that was his intention. We don't know if he was actually intending for the devices to go off. As a former investigator, when I see a 100% failure rate, that tells me that maybe that wasn't his intended goal to actually detonate these devices. But regardless, he still caused fear. He still terrorized. This is an act of domestic terrorism in my view, because it appears that it's happening for a political reason. And so when I hear that people say that, well, nothing, it didn't really go off, you know, this is crude, this guy's an idiot, he's a wacko, I think the president said, then I think they're missing the point that, look, this still caused terror. It still caused people around the country, you know, to stop. I remember, I mean, not just to get to from financial standpoint, but whenever these packages started being found, I actually went out to New York to cover the case from there. And there were so many suspicious devices being found throughout the city. You had the bomb squad that was rolling 24/7. There was one restaurant that they had a suspicious backpack outside, had to close the place down. They lost $70,000 in one night. So again, these things have, you know, these cascading consequences that people just don't really appreciate. And it all goes back to what caused this person to do what he did. And that's the conversation we're not having. It's these second, third, fourth order effects. But I just don't buy the notion when people say, well, it didn't go off. So, you know, maybe it was crude. Maybe this guy didn't know what he was doing. He still inflicted a lot of terror in this country. And I don't think that's a conversation we're having right now.
Let me ask you a couple more questions and we'll let you go. I made it a point on Spycast not to talk about the Mueller investigation. I'm going to wait till it's over before I dive deep, just because I think it's only fair. This is an investigation that has been so exceptionally good at not letting information out that they don't want to let out. And so anything I would deal with would be just speculation. So I'll take a deep dive when it's over. But I have to ask you about the clown show surrounding the Mueller investigation that popped up this week, where the FBI was brought in because of people trying to discredit the Mueller investigation through false accusations. And it's laughable if it wasn't so problematic.
No, you're right. And I think the call of the clown show is exactly right. I mean, talk about, well, let's first talk about what they were trying to achieve. They were trying to have us believe that Robert Mueller, one of the most straight-laced people on the planet to a fault, somehow went out and did all these bad things that no one knew about. And it just so happened that these people are the ones that are uncovering it, these people that are obviously fringe partisans. So setting that aside, I mean, obviously you have to consider the source, but also just the mechanics of it. I mean, I know I used to travel with Bob Mueller, used to travel with Jim Comey. I mean, one of the allegations that surfaced was that he was, you know, he somehow managed to make his way down to a bar and try to, you know, pick up a woman and then brought her back against her will to his hotel room. And I mean, even as again, someone who's traveled in the orbit of the bubble of the FBI director, I know that that's just complete nonsense because, there's no way the FBI director slips out of his room. You know, I mean, it's like a fortress whenever he travels. But again, everything about that is just ridiculous. One thing that does make me smile a little bit is seeing how this thing just completely imploded and actually seeing how adept Mueller's team was. And this shows, you know, again, how we're dealing with professionals. We're not dealing with Keystone cops that, you know, you had this group that was saying, stand by. We have this this allegation that's coming out against Mueller. And Mueller's folks actually preempted that by saying, oh, no, actually, we've already referred this to the FBI. This is nonsense. And so, again, that made me smile a little bit, just realizing that they beat them at their own game. But again, it shows that there are people out there that, you know, that run in these fringe circles that have no integrity. And, you know, they'll do whatever they can to try to discredit people that they perceive to be their enemies. I think it's a pattern that we've seen.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand trying to discredit the investigation, trying to put the Mueller team on the defensive, kind of give themselves, you know, put them in a hairy situation. But just how blatant and naked the lie was here is, I don't understand it. It seems so counterproductive to me.
And I don't know. I don't know what the end goal was. I mean, so if the goal is to say that, you know, Bob Mueller's a womanizer, it's like, well, what does that get you? Like, you're trying to discredit his. That has nothing to do with his investigative abilities. It's just you're trying to say he's a bad person, and not for nothing. But you know, obviously, the president's been on tape, bragging about sexually assaulting women. So, the whole thing is it's just so ridiculous. And again, I don't think it was well thought out. I don't know what the end goal was. Maybe we'll learn. Maybe we won't. I hope these people get a visit by the FBI and that they don't just skate away, and move on to plot and destroy someone else. But it'll be an interesting space to watch.
So let me ask you one question, a big philosophical kind of waxing philosophic question that interests me. You've run human sources, an FBI agent, secret human sources, hoping that what they told you wouldn't become public to protect those kind of resources. And now you're a journalist, kind of like on the other side of that issue, because you have sources that are actually helping you make stories public to the American people and to the people around the world. How hard was it to make this transition? Like, how do you square these two mindsets?
Yeah. So first, just a point on terminology. So I don't really like to use the word source. I didn't when I was in the FBI. I don't now, now in journalism, because source to me involves, it's transactional in nature. It's, it seems kind of one-sided. Okay, someone's going to give you something and you're going to benefit from it. But what I try to look at, both when I was in the Bureau and then even now as a journalist, is really looking at it. I call them contacts. It's really looking at it, at what's the relationship here? What's the two-way exchange of information? Obviously, someone is going to give you information as a reporter that may inform a story, but then you also can't lose sight of what is motivating that person. Is it because they're really they have concerns about what they've witnessed and they think that people should know about it? Is it a sense of, okay, they want the public to know that, these intelligence agencies are doing what we want. Here's an example of some of these things. So again, I try to focus on the two-way street there. But then also, and I hope people understand this, and I think, most journalists are like this, is I don't start my day thinking, how am I going to find some, juicy scoop or juicy nugget that's going to make me look well-connected. I start my day thinking, okay, what information have I learned about that is in the public interest? And, you mentioned the philosophical. It is very philosophical. I mean, I think about it right now. I know things that I would never publicize based on my time in government. First, because I go to jail, right? Because a lot of the stuff is classified. But also, it's a larger respect for the intelligence community. It's a larger respect for the for government writ large, that when you sign up to be a public servant, you just don't take these secrets that you learn and then go, broadcast them. And so that's an important part. And then secondly, now as a journalist, even when I learn things, I try to run through that mental calculus. Is what I'm learning in the public interest? And what is the public interest? I want to be able to articulate it. And I'll give you, a couple examples. So, during the course of doing my work now, less than a year now in journalism, we've learned things about what the government is doing and, some things that need to be pointed out as far as, alleged malfeasance. I mean, those are no brainer, right? We're going to publicize whenever the government needs to be held to account. But I'll talk to people who, provide other things that maybe are a little more sensitive in nature. So, for example, and I'm not talking about any recent case, but, in past months where, I've learned of an arrest that's coming up and talking with someone in the intelligence community, arrests at home, arrests overseas. And I think, okay, that is not in the public interest for the American people to know that an arrest is about to happen. We'll report on it once it happens, but there is very much a public safety issue there. First, I want the bad guy to be taken off the street, but also as someone who was once an FBI agent who was in the stack at the door about to breach and go in and arrest someone, I don't want that other person on the other side knowing that I'm coming. It's very much an officer safety issue. So I go through that mental calculus, whenever I learn things from contacts and, again, try to make that calculation. What is in the public interest? And once an arrest happens, we'll talk about it. So I think that's important for people to understand. One of the things that's been most fascinating for me in coming over to journalism from law enforcement and the intelligence side of the business is really appreciating the process that is in place before items make their way to television. So I always assume, you know, being on the government side, that a journalist gets something, they take it, they throw it on TV, or they write in a newspaper, and that's it. There is this rigorous process that is in place between the collection of information and when it ever makes it to the airwaves or to print. And, you know, I'll talk about my own experience. I mean, even CNN, you know, if we have reporting, that goes through this rigorous process of lawyers and fact checkers, standards and practice, right? People who think even just because we can say something, should we be saying something? Is there a public interest? And so realizing all that, that goes in that process, I hope gives people confidence that, look, you know, journalists, they try to get it right. They try to make sure that what they learn is in the public interest. And again, you know, I'm not a shill for the government. If I learn something that I think the public needs to know, then, you know, it's up to the government to try to mitigate, you know, whatever that issue is. But again, it comes down to what is really in the public interest. And there is a calculus in place, you know, whenever someone tells me something and when I actually will talk about it on television.
Well, let me end by asking you a personal question. Because you went from working in the IC, working behind the scenes jobs at the FBI where there wasn't a lot of fanfare, and now you have a job in front of the camera. This has to be madly and wildly disconcerting at times, just kind of being in the limelight when you never were before.
Yeah, it's mortifying. So going from, I mean, as you mentioned, kind of a behind the scenes person, to now the opposite of that, obviously on television, it's taken getting used to, and actually in two respects. First of all, it's required growing a thick skin, you know, in a short amount of time, because, you know, even when I came over to the journalism side, coming from the FBI, you know, there were people out there, and I'm talking about kind of the trolls, and, you know, even some prominent you know, officials close to the president who were saying some pretty nasty things without even knowing who I was. And so, you know, again, you just it requires that thick skin. And I'm not one that like lashes out and is going to go back and forth. I just let my work speak for itself. And then over time, you know, they're proven wrong that, no, I'm not a partisan or a firebrand or, just a fire breather. I'm just there to you know, help the public understand what's going on. So there's that regard. But then also it is interesting, like, you know, when you're in the FBI, and I used to laugh, like, you know, whenever I was flying somewhere, for example, overseas, obviously, you know, when I'm sitting next to someone on an airplane, they ask what you do. I'm not going to say I'm with the FBI. You know, I try to, oh, I'm with the government, or, you know, you come up with something else. Whereas here, you don't really have that luxury, but you don't really have that need either. And so in that sense, you know, I get stopped at airports and, you know, in Starbucks, and that I don't know if I'll ever get used to that, but so far it's been you know, positive, because people really want to have a conversation based on what they saw, you know, they saw me talk about on television. And so I enjoy that aspect. I'm not one who actually likes seeing my fat face on television, right? I know a lot of people are, you know, that must be a high. It's not really that. It's having the opportunity to talk about these issues, and especially to see an issue that's in the national conversation that's taking place, and to realize that I have something to add, at least that I think I have something to add that may be helpful to other people. That's what kind of motivates me, and that's what kind of drives me. And then the last thing I'll say, if I can, you know, to maybe budding journalists out there, or, you know, this is probably a good lesson for life. Whenever I first came over, I was actually talking with Anderson Cooper, and I said, "Hey, do you have any advice?" And he said, "Yeah, simple. Don't make stuff up." And that was a great lesson, he said, because, you know, people come on television and, you know, different networks, and like, people think that they have to have an answer to something. They have to know, or somehow it's some kind of – there's some judgment against them. He said, don't be that guy. If you don't know, you don't know. And so, you know, I mean, I try to live by that anyway going in, but that's really, I think, helped in this space, especially in the political environment where, you know, there's so many egos out there, and, you know, no one either wants to be wrong, or no one wants to you know, admit that they don't know something, is really, you know, not being afraid to embrace that. And I think because I didn't come from journalism, I came from the FBI where we didn't know stuff starting out, right? You admitted that, okay, I don't know something, but I'm going to go figure it out. I think it's really been helpful in this mortifying new journey.
Well, you can find Josh Campbell on CNN. He's a law enforcement analyst. You can check out a lot of his past stories on CNN.com, and also check out his Twitter feed where he opines on not only news stories, but other things that you might be interested in. I didn't even bring up some of the more esoteric Twitter posts that you have. You can go check them out for yourself.
Are you talking about pictures of my dog? Or
maybe those, or cats in Istanbul and other things like too. But
yeah.
We will have you back soon to talk about more that's going on in the news, and then we'll have you back in the fall because you've got a book coming out. But we don't get ahead of ourselves because we want to do it then. So, Josh, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us here today on SpyCast. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Vince. True pleasure.
The International Spy Museum is a full 501c3 nonprofit institution to help support future educational programming. Please visit spymuseum.org and click on our Donate Now link at the top of the page.